you all. Thank you for inviting me to give this talk, and thanks for good turnout. I was a little worried about that. This late in the semester. I'll just say, for family reasons, I live in Madison, which is great because I've been able to attend many, but not as many of the events that I've put on it this semester. In particular, it was quite ironic that last week, when Professor Willard Sunderland was here talking about the Mad Baron, I was with my students at Northern Illinois talking about the Mad Baron, but unable to get here to attend the talk. What I'm going to be giving today is, in some ways, a first draft, a first go-around of my book talk, or what I assume will be a book talk. So this is sort of well-digested material for me, but it's also sort of trying to give an overview of the project that, as I say in the acknowledgments, has been with me for over a third of my life at this point. Okay, so Northern nature inspired many individuals like Alexander Engelgart. In 1893, Tsar Alexander III promoted this active state official to the post of governor of the Arkhangelsk Gubernia province, which was an enormous territory in the north of Russia that extended at the time from the Ural Mountains all the way to Finland. Soon after his appointment, Engelgart took a trip to inspect the vast lands now under his tutelage, devoting particular attention to the natural conditions of a special selection of the dominion in the far northwest corner of the country. He saw plenty of economic potential in this region, which, along with the rest of the Russian north, at the time existed in, quote-unquote, complete stagnation. Upon his arrival, Engelgart intimated that this sparse and forbidding landscape possessed the seeds of its own renovation. Quote, in general, a sort of majestic quality comes forth, such that it seems that in these shores are hidden forces, only temporarily seized by a deep sleep, but in the mirage of this ancient silence and tranquility, the mind of the traveler already discerns a locomotive rushing here that will awaken the dormant forces all around and enliven this silently sullen and presently unpopulated place. Unquote. The rush of a locomotive certainly came during the next century, as the world's first communist country expanded economic activity in this part of the Arctic to a greater extent than even imaginable to Engelgart. The territory that he's talking about was the Kola Peninsula, or the Murmansk region administratively. This is the territory that's now in the northwest corner of Russia. Of course, it was the Russian Empire had Finland as well. And is almost entirely north of the Arctic Circle, right? Yeah. Despite its extreme northern location, it's a fairly mild Arctic part of the Arctic because it gets waters from the Gulf Stream current that makes it less cold than other parts of Siberia, for instance. This region is a mix, ecosystem-wise, is a mix of taiga and tundra. Taiga mostly, but in the upland areas, tundra. As of 1900, it had less than 10,000 inhabitants in there. By the end of the Soviet era, it had over 1 million people living in this territory. Large industrial cities, denuded and radiated landscapes, deep gashes in the mountains, contaminated waterways, and other large-scale anthropogenic change had occurred in this territory. Indeed, the region became the most populated, industrialized, militarized part of the Arctic, as well as one of the most polluted. I don't want to claim it was more polluted than Norilsk, but depending on how you conceptualize space, it's a close runner-up. I wanted to understand this transformation, how it went from sparse landscape to most built-up part of the Arctic, and the environmental dimensions of that. And in order to do so, I decided what I should do is examine several key industries that burgeoned on this territory during the Soviet period, during the 20th century. So what I do is I actually start in late imperial Russia and go through to the Putin territory, but concentrate on the Soviet period. And I look at railroad construction, phosphate mining, reindeer herding, nickel and copper smelting, and the energy sector. I don't end up stressing the large fishing industry for two reasons. One, the environmental effects of it occurred more in the sea than on the peninsula itself, and there's a lot of good scholarship by some of my environmental history colleagues on Barents fishing already. The main takeaway or finding, if you will, of my research is that environmental relations fundamentally shaped the Soviet experience. Interactions with the natural world both enabled industrial livelihoods and curtailed socialist promises. Instead of viewing the drastic changes in the North as simply a result of conquest, as other scholars, particularly Paul Josephson, have, I see the natural world as continually being involved in economic projects. That is, that nature was an actor in the communist experiment. In arguing this, I build on theory from political ecology and science and technology studies that emphasizes the active role that material features of the world play in human dramas. To cite an example from the head of the Nelson Institute here, Paul Robbins, turf grass and its particular properties have influenced the behavior of American homeowners in a myriad of ways, often enticing avowed environmentalists to environmentally destructive acts in order to preserve the greenness of their grass. While the novelty of this theory is that to afford the natural world with an active participatory potency that extends beyond static structural approaches, this isn't, you know, a warm climate predetermines political formations a la Montesquieu. It stops short of affording agency to nature. It opts instead to treat elements of the natural environment as actors that participate in history, but not necessarily with willful intentions. And in doing this, I adopt Bruno Latour's notion of an assemblage of actors affecting each other in order to give a fresh angle on Soviet power. What I see in the USSR's radical industrialization of the Kola Peninsula, therefore, is that Soviet power was simultaneously strikingly robust and rooted in inescapable materialities. The project of modernizing the North was unprecedented and involved a greater exertion of state power than hitherto possible. However, the material world maintained the potential to influence and interfere in government schemes. That is, the Soviet Union remained dependent on a material world and subject to its unpredicted intrusions throughout its existence. The USSR had not, in fact, conquered the natural world by the end of its existence, or even today. On top of making the environment a participant in Soviet history, I advance two additional overarching claims in the book and in my research. First, I highlight the presence of a dualistic conception of nature that existed throughout and beyond the Soviet era. Policymakers, industrialists, scientists often held both hostile and holistic views of the natural world. The lead industrializers of the Kola Peninsula conceived of their enterprise not only as a battlefield assault, conquest, if you will, but also as a means of enlivening and improving the Arctic and the natural world there. And this belief existed even at the height of Stalinism. Second, I aim to place the environmental experience of the region into long-term comparative perspective. On the one hand, I show how industrial buildup in the Northwest Arctic, Russian Arctic represents an attempt to modernize the North way before the current focus on opening up Arctic resources in the face of climate change. There's this whole discourse about a new North coming today. This is, in some ways, the Kola Peninsula had the new era of the new North in the 1930s. On the other hand, I treat the transformation of the Kola Peninsula as part of a global story about the pursuit of unending economic growth. This endeavor has placed such an increased pressure on Earth systems that geologists are now considering whether or not to embrace the concept of the Anthropocene formally as a new geological epoch. The story of the Kola Peninsula that I tell is in some ways one of the communist Anthropocene. Now, I'd like to turn to the industries I investigated. As I attempt to draw out the elements, I will attempt to draw out the elements that help substantiate the overarching argument about interactions with the natural world shaping Soviet power. And I'll be doing this somewhat at the expense of some of the subsidiary contentions of the different chapters and the latter two claims I just laid out for you. I begin with an examination of the construction and operation of the Murmansk Railroad, which ultimately went from Petrograd all the way up to Murmansk through much of Karelia and the Kola Peninsula. To understand this history, one needs to appreciate that two distinctive yet related ideologies about the economic use of nature came to the fore. From the middle of the 19th century until the building of the railroad during World War I, the technocratic notion that a railroad would unleash an entire treasure chest of nature dominated. As Gennady Chirkin, an official from the Imperial Resettlement Administration and a later employee of the Murmansk Railroad during the 1920s put it, the railroad would develop, quote, the economic and industrial life of the region on the basis of rational, intensive, and all-around use of natural resources and economic possibilities. Complete nature use enlivened the area with endless possibilities. This idea represented in many ways, these ideas responded in many ways to the enticing strategic and economic features of the region, which, especially in the planning phase. And this included particularly the fact that the Kola Bay, the area up here near where Murmansk was located, had a warm water harbor that didn't freeze in the winter. That's sort of the main reason they start discussing building a railway up here in the 19th century. As Engelgart noted, the territory possessed the seeds of its own renovation. That's what he was sort of talking about when he wrote that. Once a railroad was actually built, however, it was an extremely brutal experience. Austro-Hungarian prisoners of war were able to hastily build the line during what historians have called one of the worst horrors of captivity in Russia during the First World War. And this sort of gets at some of the haphazard construction that occurred. The accompanying this wartime construction, a different ideology of nature use emerged, one that was more militaristic and narrated the construction process as an attempt at battlefield conquest. The lack of compliance from the natural features of the place helped trigger these hostile interpretations of nature. The thaws that destroyed the recently built roadbeds, or the harvested trees that proved inadequate for fuel, or the polar day that prevented the few workers on this project from Central Asia from being able to break their Ramadan fast, caused officials to respond angrily by blaming the northern environment for many of these setbacks. This ideology of conquest differed from emphasizing a treasure chest because it entailed reckless and aggressive use of natural resources that was less amenable to long-term exploitation. So the key point here is that they make hasty decisions that don't actually make economic sense in the long term, partially because of the sort of militarized understanding of the natural world. These two models of assimilation and conquest further shaped railroad building in operation into the early Soviet period. During the period of the new economic policy in the 1920s, the officials rearranged the Murmansk Railroad as an industrial, quote-unquote, this is how they always talk about it, a quote-unquote industrial colonization transportation combine. This meant that it was supposed to help develop the Kola North, with subsidiary enterprises focused on timber, fishing, and mining. This territory on this map right here was all the territory that was allocated to the colonization department of the railroad for developing the region. And it was mostly forested land that was quickly denuded. This meant that during the Stalinist Great Break, however, this experiment with self-supported colonization ended, There was a return to the Marshall approaches to railroad construction that had dominated during World War I. And for the next several decades, forced laborers built new lines of the railroad in awful conditions and treated the surrounding environment as if engaged in a desperate military campaign. Now, in order to examine Stalinist industrial push more fully, I turned to a phosphate mining and town on the Kola Peninsula that was built from scratch during the first five-year plan from 28 to 32. And that's Habinogorsk, or as it's known today, Kirovsk. Here I stress that the seemingly totalistic approach of looking at such microcosms, socialist cities, as exemplars of a uniquely Stalinist civilization misses the omnipresent interactions with nature that accompanied such projects. Instead, I try to examine Stalinism as an ecosystem, one that includes everything from the civilizational approach that historians such as Stephen Kotkin and others have added, but adds the environment to it. Opting for large-scale urban development instead of a restricted mining activities, the Soviet Union, under Stalin, inaugurated a specific set of ecological relations, characterized by a combination of a strong longing for harmony with nature and peculiar forms of peacetime environmental destruction. On the one hand, this endeavor marked a departure for the Soviet experience in the far north as the country took the lead in Arctic industrialization. On the other hand, the perceived imperative to follow an industrialized West played a more influential role on this project, on this environmental evolution of Soviet socialism, than an overt project of non-capitalism. The story that begins with the geological prospecting of academician Alexander Fersman and others in the 1920s, which is the point where they discover large quantities of apatite, a phosphorus material in the Beni Mountains that can be used to produce phosphorus fertilizers. And this attracts the Soviets' attention to the region. In a bout of import substitution, Soviet planners opt to build a new socialist city in the mountains in 1929. Idealistic deliberations about how laborers were going to accord themselves with the beautiful environment and how the new enterprise would eliminate pollution altogether overlapped with existing narratives about how the Bolsheviks were going to defeat the tundra and decisions to use declassed peasants to build the place. Tens of thousands of special settlers, dekulakized peasants who had been targeted as class enemies by the Soviet state, were forced to settle this part of the north and serve the industrial cause. The ecosystem of the tundra soon bit back. Diseases spread through contaminated water. Fish in the rivers disappeared, as did the scant vegetation from emitted dust from the factories. All this worsened the experience of the people living in the north and set back the Soviet effort, but it did not halt the industrial endeavor altogether. Instead, the mining town of Kirovsk became a hub for the creation of a slew of other new mining towns in the 1930s through the 1980s. Now, just to explain the slide here, this is here the enrichment factory that they build right in the mountains. This is the town of Habinogorsk early on. This is even earlier on where they force special settlers to live in tents throughout the winter in the Arctic. And this is a slightly nicer accommodation of one of these shalmani that they build a bunch of boards. Oops, keep doing the wrong. Okay. Now, to help appreciate the depth of Soviet power that appeared on the Kola Peninsula, I next look at efforts to manage an economic activity far removed from heavy industry and even from traditional Russian agriculture, and that is reindeer herding. The USSR upheld this single animal species over more complex and variegated tundra landscape livelihoods as a means of permeating some of the most desolate territories of the country. As planners sought to make a diverse ethnic landscape of Sami, Komi, and Nenets legible through the application of abstract knowledge, they were also compelled to rely on intimate, sentient understandings from the local population. Furthermore, the reindeer themselves complicated state efforts, by reacting to schemes to manage them through deliberate behaviors of both compliance and evasion. The Sami inhabitants of the Kola Peninsula had long hunted reindeer, but they only really turned to husbandry in the late 19th century, around the time that the Komi and Nenets migrants arrived from the Pechora River region. Komi and Nenets are mostly based in sort of the northern Urals, part of just the beginning part of Siberia, and they migrated all the way around up through Karelia onto the Kola Peninsula in the late 19th century, so it was pretty far migration for them. And they brought with them their own type of reindeer husbandry. Soviet modernizers saw this practice of the Komi and decided that this should serve as a model for industrialized reindeer herding. And they had tried to apply it to the Kola Peninsula during collectivization. Though they eventually did succeed, of course, in establishing reindeer husbandry as the primary occupation of tundra dwellers, and furthermore, they ended up forcing the reindeer herders to consolidate their collective farms into only two state farms in the 1960s. The Komi models of reindeer husbandry that had been promoted by Soviet authorities had to end up being modified to Kola circumstances. As the Sami had insisted from the very beginning, forced reindeer in a peninsular environment were best left to graze on their own in the summer. This was at odds with the Komi practice of maintaining year-round surveillance, which is also makes sense in the large tundra expanse, but not on the Kola Peninsula. And essentially, the Soviets relented to this once they consolidated the collective farms and allowed for the free release of reindeer over the summer. Additionally, reindeer complicated Soviet reforms through the way that wild and domestic animals interacted with each other. Alongside collectivization in the 1930s, conservation scientists created a nature reserve, the Lapland Zapovednik, for the sake of protecting and restoring the last remaining wild reindeer population in the area. In the 1940s and 1950s, the wild reindeer from the Zapovednik frequently mixed with the domestic reindeer from a nearby kolkhoz, enticing some of the animals that were part of the collective farm, the kolkhoz, to join the wild reindeer. Collective farm members were unsurprisingly not happy with this, and resorted to poaching the wild reindeer of the Zapovednik. This conflict ended only after the Nature Reserve staff helped support the closure of the collective farm and the relocation of the reindeer during the Khrushchev era consolidation of collective farms. As I said at the... How am I on time? I got about 10 minutes. Okay. 10, 15 minutes, right? Okay. As I said at the beginning of the talk, the Kola Peninsula is known for having awful pollution. A Lonely Planet guy describing the region as hell, and a polluted hell, was one of the reasons I chose to start researching it. I might have thought better once after living there 7 months through the polar night, but, you know, that's the story of the research. And I address these issues of pollution most fully by examining the nickel and copper industry that emerged there. Which, of course, came to be responsible for huge swaths of denuded forests and allegations of creating death clouds that floated across the Norwegian border and threatened Finnish and Norwegian health as well. Just to give a sense here, these the two main locations for the nickel smelters that appear on the Kola Peninsula, Manchegorsk and Nickel, and the territory in dark black is where there's complete forest death, things like this, and then the larger territory is where there's visible forest, not all visible, but forest damage from the pollution from these smelters. And also, just as a random fact, there's this whole thing where now Syrian refugees are riding bicycles across the border to and getting into Norway from Russia, from Nickel. In my attempt to understand how this industry in the region went from being a normally destructive polluter to an especially egregious one, I take on several monolithic explanations for Soviet ecocide as inadequate to by it alone, by themselves. Now, much of the literature alternately blames either the inherent character of communism, the rapaciousness of a capitalist world system, or the limits of public input in authoritarian regimes. Now, some of these claims have something going for them, but I think that when they're taken as a single cause, they miss something else that's important and going on. So what I instead highlight is a contextual explanation that the global pressures of the 1970s and 80s helped push nickel pollution into the extreme category. And I demonstrate this by showing how from their origins in the 1930s and 1940s, the Saver nickel plant in Mochigorsk and the Pechinga nickel plant in Nikola and Zapolarny despoiled the environment at comparable levels to nickel operations elsewhere in the world. Now, don't get me wrong. This was awful. Okay, this was not good. This was a lot of pollution. But it wasn't necessarily worse than the Sudbury mines in Canada or the nickel operations in New Caledonia in the Pacific French colony. In the late 1960s, for instance, sulfur dioxide emissions had even stabilized or started to decrease moderately. Then in the 1970s, they skyrocketed and crossed certain ecological thresholds, which drastically accelerated the damage that occurred on the surrounding landscape. It was in this period when the denuded zones proliferated to thousands and thousands of square kilometers. Or the denuded zones was about 1,000 square, the damage was thousands of square kilometers. This was all related to the dramatic increase in production, which was aimed at economic growth, though achieved less of it in the deindustrializing 1970s. Another factor important for understanding this peak in Soviet pollution is that the materials being used in the process started generating more pollution against the hopes of Soviet planners. In the nickel industry, this occurred largely because the mines in Mochigorsk became exhausted, and instead they started shipping in higher sulfur nickel ore from Norilsk. And that created a lot more sulfur fumes per unit produced. In the apatite industry, the phosphate industry, one of the long-standing goals from the very beginning of the planning was that they would reuse all the nepheline wastes and minimize and, in fact, they said eliminate pollution. Instead, what happened is that despite actually doing some reuse of nepheline tailings to produce aluminum, the amount did not keep pace with the production. So the nepheline itself became a major pollutant of the waterways in the region and through dust, creating dust from the tailings. And this graph right here just sort of quickly shows both the dramatic rise in apatite production, which there's a comparable situation going on with nickel production at the factories, but then also on this bottom one right here, the fact that nepheline being produced did not keep pace with apatite being produced, which meant more wastes. Okay. Now, the other main pollution concern on the Kola Peninsula has been nuclear wastes. I'll conclude my investigation, therefore, with an examination of the energy economy in the region. For each of the different energy resources mobilized to fuel industrial development in this part of the Arctic, a comparable dynamic played out. Burning wood and peat, diverting rivers for hydroelectric dams, importing coal and oil, and splitting atoms at a nuclear power plant brought major changes to the Kola environment, but also re-entangled Soviet society with its surrounding environment in new and intricate ways. Soviet power transformed the northern environment, but it never transcended it. Though the region possessed plenty of mineral resources, it lacked major supplies of fossil fuels. To supplement this dearth, industrializers tossed tremendous quantities of trees into furnaces, especially in the first half of the century, most of which had been near the Murmansk Railroad, and proposed schemes to excavate peat, though those never took off as much as they had hoped. They also more excitedly embraced the use of white coal, which is hydroelectric energy, in order to be a battery in the region. And from the 1930s to 1980s, 17 hydroelectric facilities were installed on the region's rivers. Some of the earlier ones with prison labor, here's prisoners at the Neva hydroelectric dam, and others with more in the 1960s with Finnish laborers, actually. That was part of the whole Soviet-Finnish trade bartering pact. Some of these hydroelectric facilities, such as the Upper Tuulomaa hydroelectric dam, inundated vast quantities of the landscape. So this is the dark blue here is stuff that was part of the river beforehand, and the light blue shows all of the territory that was inundated with one of these hydroelectric plants. The scale here isn't perfect, but it's a considerable territory. It's become the second largest lake in the region, the reservoir for this hydroelectric plant.
You know what the scale is on the topo map?
Oh. No, I have a better map in the book, but it's not. But the color doesn't show up. Let me go back and show you. Oops. So wait. So that's just given. So this one is that's 100 kilometers, mm-hmm. and there's the inundated part of the Tuulomaa, mm-hmm. and it's not quite as big as Lake Imandra right here, but it's. The second largest reservoir. All of these hydroelectric facilities, however, did not keep pace with the demand emerging from into the industrializing and urbanizing Kola Peninsula. This changed, however, with the advent of nuclear power in the region. The Kola nuclear power plant in Polarny Zory came online in the 1970s and 80s, and it joined an already burgeoning nuclear establishment of icebreakers and naval submarines. This dramatic buildup led to the point where the Kola Peninsula possessed roughly a fifth of the world's nuclear reactors operating at one point. That was in the late 1980s. Much of the waste from these facilities was stored in unsafe and leaky storage units, while plenty of it was also dumped in the sea. The population was largely unaware of the hidden risks of radiation in the area, including when they detonated nuclear explosions for pulverizing ore in the Hibini Mountains in both the 70s and the 80s. While nuclear power solved the energy dearth and made the area more livable in some sense, there was enough electricity, it also embedded Arctic residents into a landscape with new natural perils and environmental perils. This is the inside of the Kola nuclear power plant, and this is children jumping right next to the Kola nuclear power plant in the water that's being used as a cooling pond. Now, as I've gone through these industries, I've somewhat glossed over the voices of a lot of the people who colonized the Soviet Arctic. And I've done this mostly for the sake of trying to give an overview of the entire project in a 40, 45-minute talk. To wrap up, though, I want to look at the perspective of one of the individuals who came to the region. And that's a woman named Inna Tartakovskaya. She was born in Odessa in 1905, right in the midst of the 1905 revolution. And then she found herself in the recently renamed Leningrad in the 1920s. There she pursued her dreams of becoming a ballerina at first, while she was working at a bank. At the bank, she met a guy named Vasily Kondrakov and married him. His career ambitions were soon interrupted, however, when well-known, prominent Bolshevik Sergei Kirov decided to hire her husband to manage the new industrial enterprise in the Hibini Mountains in Habinogorsk, Apatit. She even followed Kirov's personal advice and enrolled in a technical school in order to help boost her husband's shaky knowledge of phosphate mining and enrichment. One of my favorite comical stories of this is when this guy, this is Tartakovskaya, this is her husband, Vasily Kondrakov. When he was appointed to head Apatit, a new Apatit mining and processing enterprise, he said, "Что такое Apatit? What is Apatit?" He hadn't heard of the mineral before, and he was being put in charge of this enterprise. During her husband's meteoric rise as a captive coal industry in the 1930s, Tartakovskaya spent much of more and more time in the far north working as a much-needed technical specialist. Tara then threw this unanticipated life into disarray. Not only was her husband arrested and shot, Tartakovskaya herself ended up spending a long stint in Siberian gulag camps. And this is where, this is actually a drawing of her that was done of her while she was in Kolyma. During the thaw era, she returned to a technical institute in Leningrad and made several business trips back to the Kola Peninsula. She also started recording her recollections as a veteran of the Soviet North. She died in 1990, but she, throughout the 70s and 80s, she was talking about her experience quite a lot. And in these reflections, she dwelled considerably on the natural environment. Like many of the supposed conquerors of the North, Tartakovskaya possessed both an aesthetic and scientific appreciation for coal and nature. She just described the beauty of first seeing the Mancha Tundra from Lake Amandra in 1934. She also recalled northern nature as an obstinate presence. Some of the complications of industrial projects, quote, rested in the harsh and unlivable character of the North. She spoke of how, quote, one worker did not arrive at work at one time because he could not leave his cold, wet lodging in which he was frozen. The clothes were frozen and the bedsheets were frozen to the ground. In her writings, such disruptions of coal of nature also intruded into the experiments with flotation reagents used during apatite enrichment and in the catastrophic avalanches that hit Kirovsk in the second half of the 1930s. By acknowledging these frequent setbacks, Tartakovskaya seems to have understood that the conquest of nature was much more of an aspiration than an accurate portrayal of the Soviets' relationship to the environment. And that's a contention I've been insisting upon today. Thank you.
Questions for
you? You mentioned Kolyma just now.
Mm-hmm.
I was wondering, was there anything in this part of the Soviet Union equivalent to Dalstroy in the Soviet Far East?
Yeah, I mean, there were nothing equivalent to Dalstroy, nothing as on the comparable scale of the huge Far East camps or the ones in Varkuta or some of those others. But there were plenty of gulag camps. Mm-hmm. Severnica was built by gulag prisoners. The lower Toloma hydroelectric plant was built by gulag prisoners. So there was a whole larger, the subsidiary railroad lines after the Malamans Railroad were built by gulag prisoners. But there were smaller camps, a lot of them actually based out of subsections of the White Sea Baltic Combine. That was one of the first gulag projects. Jack?
You mentioned your focus today mostly on the Soviet stuff.
Yeah.
Could you give a bit of an overview of what it looks like now under Putin?
So it's a weird mix, okay? So it's, of course, depopulated. It's now under, it's 700 something thousand instead of over a million, instead of 1.1 million. Murmansk itself has done okay. I mean, it's still a depressing provincial city, but it's done okay because of this sort of idea of they're going to expand oil, offshore oil drilling. That's sort of led to there being investment in the industrial towns, except for Apatiti, which still has a scientific establishment, are quite depressed. And so that's become, the social situation has gotten in some ways, well, not worse, more worse during the 90s, but hasn't improved much during Putin. Environmentally, deindustrialization and the collapse of production did wonders. You know, I mean, the nickel enterprises are not spewing out anywhere near the quantity of pollution as they did in the Soviet era. So the pollution's gone down as well as population.
I was just wondering if there were any like attempts at conservation efforts during the Soviet Union, or if the Soviets even acknowledged kind of the amount of pollution being created, or just how they treated that.
Yeah. So two answers. One is there was. At the exact same time that they're starting to industrialize this region, they're establishing a nature reserve. And these nature reserves in the Soviet Union were in many ways, especially in this earlier period, were in many ways more radical than anything you saw in the West. It was this notion that there was we're going to set aside this territory. Actually, let me go back to the... This territory right here is all set aside as a nature reserve. So a fairly large territory set aside, and we're not going to touch it. It's not for tourism. It's not the Grand Canyon. It's not for backpackers. It's for preservation and scientific research alone. Now, that, of course, gets challenged at different times by Soviet authorities. That nature reserve closes for several years in the 1950s before it's restored. There's poaching that occurs on it. There's obviously one of the fumes from the nickel smelter destroying some of the territory here. So that's all going on. But the people who were involved in it were quite active and had, you know, positions of influence within the sort of local people on the ground industrializing this place. There's one time where this Kondrakov guy says, you know, this, the head of the Zapovednik and his wild reindeer are all nice, but they should be more practical. But I mean, that's both, of course, in speaking to this, you know, anti-environmentalism of the industrial leaders, but also the fact that they're having to contend with the influence of that this guy has over this territory. The other thing that I would say is that there's actually quite a bit of acknowledgement of the environment as something to take care of, especially from the 60s on, but that was often very, you know, that was greenwashing. It was about face. It was like, oh, you know, well, we have to take care of it. You know, environmental issues are one of the most important things facing the world today, but, you know, we're not actually going to talk about the pollution that's destroying the environment. We're just going to say that we should all preserve nature, we should all protect our green friend, things like that. Mm-hmm.
What was the social response to the nuclear pollution that was going on in this region? Let me show that picture of children jumping into contaminated water. It's quite disturbing. So I just wonder if the Soviet authorities attempted to bribe the population with perhaps better living conditions so that the population would, you know, be quiet about it, or this was the situation?
So there was certainly a Plutopia story going on here where referring to Kate Brown's book, where there's people sort of trading consumer comforts, especially in like Polarny, Zori, and even in some of the military towns, to be honest, trading better creature comforts for living with nuclear risks. There's also a lot of a lack of knowledge about it, right? I mean, when these nuclear power plants come online, the dialogue in the newspapers is, hey, this is going to stimulate nature, this is a good thing for the environment, it's good to warm the river, the lake a little bit because they'll get more fish there, at least it's not producing as much carbon dioxide, which is, you know, the argument made in favor of nuclear power today, right? So they were saying the same things that you hear the nuclear industry saying today back in the 1970s. They weren't acknowledging the waste problems, though, so a lot of people didn't know that. It becomes a more concerted effort starting in the during Perestroika after Chernobyl, and especially in the 1990s after Yakovlev releases this report that exposes how much the northern fleet of the Soviet Navy had been dumping into the sea. And at that point, you get actually quite a lot of concern. So it's a very sort of schizophrenic situation there today where, you know, half the people say that they don't want the nuclear power in the region, but, you know, they're not about to get on the streets and protest about it either.
A similar question. I know from a dissertation that was done here that in Czechoslovakia in the 60s and 70s, there's quite a debate emerged in coal mining areas between public health authorities, mm-hmm. The industrial ministries, and then the physicians' communities caught in the middle. You get similar debates from within various competing or contending official structures over these issues, because they have to
Yeah.
Public health guys have to be getting epidemiological reports on certain types of diseases.
And yeah, they very much are. Actually, that's a very interesting question about whether or not there was some sort of doctors playing a mediating role between them. But no, in some ways, one of the heroes of my story would be the sanitation inspectors,
mm-hmm.
who keep filing these reports saying, hey, look at how much smog we're producing. Look at the health effects it's having on children. Look at all these diseases that are happening. Look at the phosphorus in the water. And they're doing that from the 1930s on. One of the more biting ones is actually from the middle of the 1930s, and it's just shoved under the rug. In the Stalinist period, they're more like, well, we're trying to do this, but that. But they do occasionally have influence. For instance, one of the acts that's taken in the 1950s and 1960s is relocating certain of these settlements that are in the most toxic zones to relocating those residents elsewhere. Right now, you know, this, you can say this is just saying the solution to pollution is dilution, right? It's not actually declining the pollution loads, but it is responding slowly and inadequately to health concerns being raised by sanitation inspectors.
Yeah, so could you talk a little bit about your archival research and your trip to the region, like how you got into the story, like where you found the documents, and when you talked about those individuals,
so
that was really fascinating. I'd love to hear more about that.
Okay, so the archival experience was mostly 7 months in Murmansk, using the regional archive, and actually using something that was just as valuable, which was the regional library. It was just as valuable because it was open from early in the morning until 8 at night, and it had a whole Karvechesky Adel with a card catalog that had everything sort of organized towards what I wanted to know about. This is where that puppet theater is, right? Your friend works? Yeah. So I worked there. The main sort of files that sort of created the kernel of it was actually the personal fund of this guy, Kondrikov. And that's where I ended up getting some of these personal stories. I ended up finding tons of material in Moscow, and that sort of helped bolster this in more. So I worked in, the Murmansk archive, the Kirovsk file of the Murmansk archives, and then all of the sort of main Moscow archives. The thing I didn't do is I didn't do too much on the nuclear stuff. That stuff came from the sort of watchdog reports published by foreign NGOs mostly later on. I read the newspapers, I got what I could from there, but I made the collective choice not to risk imprisonment. does that answer most of it? I'm trying to think. Is there anything else you'd like?
Yeah, no, I was just wondering. Sometimes when people do work on a region, it's always really interesting to find out what they couldn't find in Moscow. What materials were really unique to the archives
and
the collections in that particular
region? What I think it would mostly be is the enterprise level.
Mm-hmm.
So, and in many ways, this actually helped shape what I ended up looking at broadly. Because process-wise, I did more of the research on, railroad, the phosphates, the nickel industry, the different hydroelectric plants, the reindeer. Different reindeer collective farms from the local archives, and then getting a sense of that, and then going back and sort of seeing how the center was looking at these places gave me, I think, a very different perspective than if I had just been going top down, because I saw the actions and the debates and the contestations of some of the stuff coming from the center on the ground first, and then sort of like, oh, that's what they were responding to. So, part of me thinks I should have started with more time in Moscow because it would have been more efficient. Part of me, though, is very happy I did it this way because of getting that perspective. Yeah.
Do you know if any red books, if you're familiar with those, the cataloging of endangered plants and animals, have any of those been put out for this part of Russia?
Yeah, there's a whole Krasnaya Kniga, Murmansk Oblast, that I believe begins in the either the late 70s or early 80s, mm-hmm. and is updated continually throughout. I don't know what the most recent findings of the Red Book have been. Mm-hmm. There's also, of course, right now, all sorts of discussion about, you know, the fact that the tree line is changing and the effects of climate change are being felt quite dramatically, especially in the upland territories of this region. The Gulf Stream current means that it's not like, you know, the Arctic warming's already been something like 3 degrees, and that's more dramatic in the colder parts of the Arctic than this, but it's still quite dramatic. Yeah.
And when you showed the tables showing kind of the uptick in production, especially in the 70s, if I'm not mistaken, before then, I'm just curious, how much of this is reacting to increased demand, like a market,
yeah.
and how much is just forced production to support the goals of the plant?
No, that's great. It's a combination of both, because by this point, they're definitely selling plenty of this phosphorus on the international market. They're also selling less, but still considerable nickel and copper abroad, too. The nickel, I mean, I can actually respond to the nickel and copper thing a little bit more clearly. That's, you know, it's not as flexible or nimble as capitalist markets, but production levels are following what's happening in other nickel producing countries at the time, where the price is going up and they're raising production. What ends up happening is the sort of systemic costs of the plant economy, of the command economy, end up overwhelming any sort of gains that are happening. So they are responding to markets, but not international markets, but not nearly as attentively as, you know, other producers are. It's not just production for production.
Okay,
the hidden thing about the nickel demand and copper demand is that we still don't see how much of it was coming from the military. We have a general sense that a lot of it internally was coming from the military, but we don't necessarily see that.
I was wondering, to what extent, or how does this compare in extent or amount of damage to the zones they found in the former East Germany? You know, some that look like moonscapes almost, because of the brown coal.
Closely, mm-hmm. right? Especially places like this, especially the nickel zones. The environmental damage near Kirovsk and in the Hibini Mountains is less visible. Mm-hmm. But this is one of the things. This is a combination of tons of acid rain mm-hmm. produced by the sulfur dioxide fumes, plus heavy metals, and this is the same thing you get in other large nickel smelting territories. Mm-hmm. They didn't have any in eastern Germany, I don't think, but some in eastern Europe, but more in Canada and elsewhere. So it's comparable to the sort of, you know, or the Canadian tar sands. These territories right around Montegorsk and nickel are similarly destroyed, but through somewhat different processes because of the type of pollution. Yeah?
So according to your research, do you think the constructive activities of Gulag a very important source of environmental pollution?
The construction activities of the Kulaks?
Yeah.
So yes and no. On the grander scheme of this, making this happen, no. On the grander scheme of large-scale destructive change to this environment, no. On the scale of right at the time, the living situation making the waterways polluted, yes. I mean, one of the main ways that some of the waterways in these special settlements become polluted is that people go to the bathroom there. People do their laundry in them. And this is supposed to be where they're getting their drinking water from. So that type of pollution was actually quite related to the activities of the special settlers.
Yes, so the pollution is very, a kind of fundamental pollution, not kind of industrial pollution.
Yeah, and that'd be more like municipal pollution or something like that. Yeah. I mean, and besides that, then the fact that they're helping build these factories and that are admitting this, they're obviously contributing to it too. But the that would be the same if they were for hired laborers too.
Then, thank you, Andy, for a great presentation.
Yeah,